On this week's 51%, meet a woman whose calling is to carry the water.
Water is the life giver, and so we care for that element.
And the iconic Righteous Babe has written a memoir. We'll hear more from Ani DeFranco. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Carol Blodgett has wrapped up her 9th annual Water is Life Walk, the first to include New York's Hudson River. Blodgett was carrying water from the Hudson source to New York Harbor, where she emptied it into the sea. It's part of her mission to restore the human-to-water connection, and after all, women are the water carriers. I'd caught up with Blodgett toward the end of her walk about a month after she began. Called Grandmother Carol, or Unchi Carol, by many around her, Blodgett has Penobscot lineage through her maternal grandmother, but was not raised in the tribe.
Long story short, I carry a bundle that is a bundle of responsibility. And so the responsibility was to always keep my personal decisions based on what's best for the next seven generations and of everything on this planet, not just human beings or not just indigenous children. And so with that context, in 2011, on my Omblesha, my vision quest, I was taken to the water. And so I have been carrying our waters because nothing lives without water. If we don't take care of that, then we don't have anything. We're in a mass extinction event right now. And the reality is we're not top on the food chain. You know, we live on everything that walks, swims, flies, or grows on this planet. And so we have a responsibility to care for those things. And so the indigenous life teachings or original instructions are that we have to live in harmony with everything. And so as indigenous people, we're really beginning to stand up and say, we have to get back to that. You know, we have to get back to that. And so you'll see us standing up everywhere for our water, for our land, for our sacred sites, because we're at the time where we don't have an option anymore. You know, our prophecies and our elders have been warning us for a long time, and those warnings have not been heeded by most of the dominant society. And so we just have to get more vocal. We have to get more visible. And so I carry the waters because the women were always the water carriers. We're the life givers. Water is the life giver, and so we care for that element because we share, as women, we share so much with the water. We share the same cycle. There's 28 days in a new moon, 28 days in a new moon. Our feminine cycle is 28 days, and the moon controls the tides. And so we swell, you know, and then it goes away, and then we swell, and then it goes away. And that's the tide within our body as well as the tides within our oceans. And our rivers and our oceans are the blood vessels of our mother. And the tide ebbs and flows just like the heart beats, moving that water in and out. And through our body, our heart beats. And so that's kind of the ebb and flow of the tides. And, you know, we need to acknowledge that you can't keep putting these obstructions on our waterways and expect our mother to be healthy.
She began her walk June 3rd at the source of the Hudson in the Adirondacks, and she describes what has impacted her most along the Hudson.
The beauty of that river early on is phenomenal. Even the beauty down here is phenomenal. However, even early on in the headwaters, just before you reach Henderson Lake, which is what they now call the headwaters, actually, it's up at Lake Tear in the clouds. You see the results of old mining of, you know, there's an old blast furnace where they mined iron ore, and you see how the river was diverted and changed for the logging process over the years. And so those kind of things are early on in the river. And then we begin to hit sewer treatment plants and storage depots for fuels of all kinds right on our waters. Sewer treatments are always on the water. And, you know, they test what comes out of that sewer treatment flow. But that what they can't test is what happens when it rains. And all those little tanks overflow and then go down into the river. And that's where you get your fecal contamination in the water, is because there's no cover on them. And so, you know, we have Indian Point. So we're putting in prayers before that and after that to, you know, to keep the water healthy. And before every sewer treatment plant, and after every sewer treatment plant, before and after dams, and locks our dams. Even though we don't see it that way, it blocks that flow of blood. So it's just a lot of very mixed moments of beauty and happiness, and seeing people connect because they see you connecting. It's just beautiful, but it's also painful. It's just a huge mix of those moments. After the first 7 walks, it became very clear to me that what's happening with our waters is not as much of what we're doing, but why we allow it. Why do we allow it to happen? Because we no longer see water as our source of life. It's just a resource. But we spent our first 9 months in the water. Everything we eat is here because of water. We wouldn't exist on a daily basis if we didn't have water. It's our first medicine. You know, if we don't have it clean, we can't have clean food. You know, to me, it's so simple and yet so invisible because it has become a resource, and we've been indoctrinated to see it that way. So my main focus is to try to get people back to the understanding of this is our source of life. It's not a resource, and to awaken our responsibility to care for that element.
Blodgett's previous walk was along the Housatonic River, a river that runs through western Connecticut and Massachusetts.
Nebi gazamovina gajiwali wani nebi gajita mita hamovina. Nebi gazamovina gajiwali wani nebi gajita mita hamovina. Nebi gazamovina gajiwali wani nebi gajita mita hamovina. Nebi gazamovina gajiwali wani nebi gajita mita hamovina.
That was the Penobscot Water Song, written by Gabriel Paul, who is from the Crow and Eel Clan. The song is performed by his niece, Lee Neptune, also from the Eel Clan. We've included interviews with Ani DeFranco a few times on 51% over the past few years. The Grammy Award-winning musical artist and feminist is known for her social activism and political engagement, through song and otherwise. DeFranco's poetry and lyrics pierce social convention and challenge the status quo. And she's out with her new book called No Walls and the Recurring Dream. DeFranco's coming-of-age story is defined by her ethos of fierce independence, from being an emancipated minor sleeping in a Buffalo bus station to unwaveringly building a career through appearances at small clubs and festivals to releasing her first album at the age of 18 to consciously rejecting the mainstream recording industry and creating her own label, Righteous Babe Records. 51%'s Joe Donahue spoke with DeFranco about an array of topics, starting with her memoir.
What compelled you, do you think? What was the straw that broke the back to say, yeah, I'd like to tell my story?
Yeah, right. Put my toe in the memoir waters. I mean, for one thing, I needed a challenge. You know, I needed a writing challenge after hundreds of songs and poems. And for another thing, honestly, I have kids now, and this business of mommy continuing to be a road dog, you know, while the kids and daddy, you know, are back home, it's hard. It's hard on the whole family unit. So it was a part of my sort of oblique strategy now of how can I still be me and still be engaged but be home more.
We'll go further into deeper places here in a second, but I can't get away from the cover of the book. Can you tell me about the photo on the cover of the book?
Yeah, well, it's a picture of me from, 1993, I'm guessing. And it's, I was up on the roof of what was then the Righteous Babe Records offices in Buffalo. The cover of the book, the backdrop of Buffalo, downtown Buffalo, has been removed, and there's just these sort of celestial clouds in its place. I was not actually floating in heaven. I was downtown Buffalo, and that moment of sort of goofiness where I strike the muscle man pose just because I don't know what to do when a camera is pointed my way became the Righteous Babe Records logo. And that photograph, I traced it with a marker, and that was our logo, and that sort of followed me around for the rest of this journey and become a sort of a symbol of my stance in the world, I guess.
Because it is you on sort of, this is what it says to me. I'm on top of the world, and here I am, and yes, I'm a righteous babe, and there's no, and you're not going to do anything about it. I'm here, I'm ready to go.
Yeah, I'm free, I'm strong, which is, and I talk about a little briefly in the book about the moment of that photograph, you know, it's just another delicious irony if you're me, because it was me coping with feeling trapped in front of a camera and uneasy and unsure of my, and it's, you know, so I make a funny moment out of it and as a way of coping, and then this comes to represent true self-possession, you know, but I love the way you can sort of transform these moments for yourself and even others along the way.
Even though that's what the photo portrays to us, is that how you were feeling?
Right. No, that's what I'm saying. I was feeling very nervous, very unsure of myself, very not sure of how to be me in front of a camera. There's something about a camera for me that's always felt sort of like they're made of kryptonite, you know?
And yeah, but not even a camera, but in life. I mean, of where you were at that point, of how confident you were of what you were doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I was not to be stopped, that's for sure. I was on a mission of some sort, and I was going to, you know, stay on it with all my heart and soul if it killed me. Was I confident about it? I had a lot of self-doubt along the way, that's for sure. I had to wake up and remind myself every morning, why am I doing this independent thing and not just signing a record deal or whatever the choices that I was making along the way? I had to keep reminding myself, what is the point here, you know?
You obviously write about your family life, and you were emancipated. What brought you to that point where there had to be that split?
Well, my family sort of split itself in many parts, and my mother, who I was living with as a tween, you know, early teen, she moved out of state to rural Connecticut. And that was just, I was already forming a life in Buffalo, New York. I had friends, I had gigs that I was already getting, I had songs that I was writing and things I had to do. So I stayed in Buffalo when my mom moved away at 15, and that was sort of when I really embarked on, being self-directed.
In that self-direction, I mean, you think of that story and you think 15, my God, that must have been very scary. But I guess this brings us back to a question of an understanding or a confidence in what you were doing, that this was worth the effort. This was worth what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of moments of trepidation and exhaustion and et cetera. But, you know, right from the beginning, I was blessed with moments where people would come out of the fog of sort of resistance. And I was experiencing a lot of pushback against my music, against the things I expressed in my songs, the stories I told. But through that pushback came these moments of affirmation, almost with a desperation behind them. You know, these mostly in the beginning young women, but not always. People that would come and grab me by my shoulders and look me in the eye and start crying and say, thank you for saying that. And those moments hit so much deeper than the sort of fog of resistance around me. So those sustained me and made me keep going.
The independence of wanting your own label, of doing it by yourself. That would seem to me to come from somebody who'd been burned by a system and then decided, all right, screw it, I'm going to do it myself. But you always had the sense that it would work better for you if you were the person in charge of it.
Yeah. I mean, I had some knowledge of, and then more and more as I continued on a life in music, of artists who were struggling with their labels, who they didn't understand them, they didn't support them, they didn't, you know, there was this tension. But much more than those experiences, or not wanting to have that happen to me, really, because honestly, I couldn't imagine that happening to me, you know, some label people telling me what to wear and play the single and smile pretty and whatever the game, you know, I couldn't see myself playing that role so much. And the point for me was just to not engage at all in that system, which I think is, you know, I just sort of, you know, I was an idealistic kid, and I saw the forces of capital and the forces of culture and art as being sort of in conflict. And so I wanted to go with the art, with the mission, you know, of political evolution, and how could I contribute there? And it seemed like marrying myself, partnering with profit-motivated entities was not the right choice.
And when did you know that for you it was the right choice? I mean, was there ever a trepidation of saying, oh boy, all right, this is going to be harder than I thought?
Yeah, a decade or two of that.
Yeah.
Of going, oh man, what am I doing? You know, so like seeing, you know, just the experience, the repeated experience of having a young artist opened for me, you know, in some bar somewhere. And then a year later, she's on the cover of every magazine. You know, she's got the MTV video all day long, and I'm back in that bar, you know. And it happened many times, you know, and watching the path not taken, you know, sort of stretch out in the other direction and me sort of staying on my path. It was a hard daily choice in the beginning. But in retrospect, of course, I feel lucky. And even some people who went the more traditional route turn now to my position and with envy at this point. So I feel blessed that in the long game, this sort of insistence on making my own mistakes and following my own path has led me to a great place.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but in my reading of your book, those decisions that you made rarely had an impact on the art, though. If anything, they helped the art. the music, the art that then is allowed to be pure and ultimately what you want it to be.
Well, I do like your interpretation. I think it is true that there is a lot of purity of expression. There is a incredibly indigenous to me sounds that I've put on record. Indigenous to me in that moment and that moment and that. You know, in retrospect, if you're me, it's hard not to have regret about not bringing in the team of professionals, you know, like ever, to help me translate my songs to a broader audience. I just have to, you know, the thing I kept telling myself and the thing I keep continue to tell myself is that it's more important to have reached a very specific audience with a very specific need, like people who felt just like I did, you know, a bit desperate, a bit alone, like they're fighting an uphill battle to be even included, to be to exist in their own society. You know, I think my expressions on tape reached that core group of people, not all young women like myself, but people who are living the same experience for in whatever way, you know. And so, you know, I probably could have reached more people with, you know, the right mixers and producers and translators, but I think that the path that I was on and the audience that has sort of gathered around me have been really, there's a deep meaning and a deep relationship there that I wouldn't trade for fame, you know.
But you, when you say you wouldn't trade for fame, but I mean, you have, do you have the fame you wanted? I mean, do you have the fame? You are certainly, I think, by many, if not most measures, famous.
Yeah. I didn't mean to say that. Yeah, I've been just sort of off on the sidelines. I certainly have been, you know, extremely grateful for this platform that people have offered me, that they've supported me on. You know, I'm so grateful that now when I open up my mouth and I let out the pain, the struggle, the perspective, the vision, the experiences, the truth of my own life, there is somebody there willing to take it in, to listen. It's been a great blessing for me. You know, it's been incredibly healing for me. And yes, I absolutely have the kind of fame I want, which is not a mega fame, just an authentic, you know, relationship with an audience based on really just being real with them and them opening themselves up to me in return. And that is what I've been searching for in music all along, you know?
We have about a minute and a half left. I am curious as to the, having been an outspoken activist for your entire career, of what that is like in today, now, in this environment, in this climate.
Oh, even more necessary. I mean, it's just always been incredibly necessary that we stay accountable to our society. You know, I mean, I talk about it a little bit in the book. If you drop the ball even for a second, it rolls backwards. You know, this whole thing is sloped, you know, towards the powerful and the moneyed. And so we have to be vigilant, you know, and I, especially in this present climate, you know, I think it's a matter of turning to the people to your left and right and joining forces with them in doing the good work of the world and finding a way in whatever your job is to make yourself accountable to your society.
That was Ani DeFranco speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue. Her new book is a memoir called No Walls and the Recurring Dream.
If I had school, I would teach Gandhi and Dr. King and Aung San Suu Kyi. I'd teach techniques of nonviolence part of the core. 'Cause any kid can add two and two if you show him a path.
This is Bird Note. In summer, across much of North America,
A sudden flash of orange and black in the treetops usually means one thing. Orioles. Baltimore Orioles in the east. Bullock's Orioles in the west. And Hooded Orioles in the southwest and California. These vividly colored birds return each spring from Mexico and Central America, and their brilliant orange feathers remind us of the tropics. With slender, sharply pointed bills, orioles weave nests that hang like pendants. You can spot these hanging nests most easily in the cooler months, when the trees have lost their leaves. The nest resembles a woven pouch, suspended from a slender branch. The female builds it in about a week, meticulously weaving long, flexible strands of grass, and sometimes adding in man-made materials she finds, too. Look carefully at an oriole's nest, and you may discover bits of yarn, twine, fishing line, and maybe even a colorful ribbon the wind carried away from a backyard birthday party. Can't get out to see an oriole right now? Then come to our website for some photos of these astonishingly beautiful songsters and their nests. That's birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1564.